Blog Talk Radio.
Brother, one GP wonder. Okay, listen, we're all a part of the bigger plan. You wanna stand by yourself or take a stand? Shit, I guess we all have been misled, cause what they say might just fuck with your head. Now the word is out in 91,000 documents, so I don't need to speak the truth about the government. The results are secondary evil, and the orders that kill innocent people. Rapid machine gun fire spit, a potty chopper hit and keep on shooting. I call them killers in the cockpit. The world's sick, we all have to admit we aim to kill and shoot. With a trigger itch, we're going down. I can see people dying. Can't you see all the bodies multiplying? Can't you hear the women and children crying? Are you blind, motherfucker? Can't you see we need to wake up? Let's wage against the machine, cause this is not a fantasy. This is not a dream. This is the reality. This is what we see. And if you think you're free, I beg to disagree.
I guess we're sleeping with our minds closed, eyes shut, cold inside and afraid to wake up. We walk around like zombies left for dead, and when we speak our mind, they shoot us in the head. I guess we're stupid and easy to trick. We go to war for freedom when it's all politics. So we walk around like zombies left for dead. Let me speak my mind and catch a bullet in my head.
A rhyming God speaking. You need to wake up, no Tylenol PM. The revolution, a better solution. Restitution, retribution. Texas shooting, death is ruined. Better music than your generation. Sinners, hatred, litigation. Kill the nation, winners, patrons. Did displacement, wicked sensation. The tempest was timid when he entered the oasis. I have met with the oracle, speech was rhetorical. In the morning, they are mourning you, it is honorable. But when you fight for what you believe, you are remembered by a mark on the sleeve. The funeral parlor, consuming the horror. We move for tomorrow, and usually proper, consuming your offer to the tomb where they brought us. You can't kill a thought, you can't kill an idea. You can shoot me in the head, but can't kill my mind either. The rhyme seeker, divine speaker, time reacher, line preacher, designed to seek ya. Follow us down the path of the righteous. If you don't like us, from darkness to where light is.
I guess we're sleeping with our minds closed, eyes shut, cold inside and afraid to wake up. We walk around like zombies left for dead, and when we speak our mind, they shoot us in the head. I guess we're stupid. Easy to trick, we go to war for freedom when it's all politics. So we walk around like zombies left for dead. Let me speak my mind and catch a bullet in my head.
Yes, that was Sheepy from Norway with Left 4 Dead featuring Mark Deves. And I am Solomon, and I will be joined by Peter Fowler. And most importantly, this is Your World News, and this is Your World News community radio station. We have a very important, it's all business today. It is all business today, as if it isn't always business on Your World News. But today, it's straight business. Peter and I are in a special kind of mood, in a very honorary mood, because we got some very important things to discuss. Well, first of all, we have Keith Harmon Snow, who's going to be joining us, and he's going to be breaking down his last two articles. On Libya, and the other one on Japan. And the nuclear apocalypse in Japan, and he's going to be breaking some significant information that has yet to be fully disclosed on the corporate media. And we're also going to be talking about his previous article before that on Libya, which
is extremely relevant right now because the U.S. has just gone ahead and invaded, along with NATO. And we know that U.S. controls much of NATO. We know that, all right? But the U.S. and its NATO sycophants and its Arab League sycophants, co-signed onto this so-called unilateral invasion, and it's absolutely repulsive. It's repulsive, and it's kind of it's also repulsive that the Arab League, which co-signed onto this, with their tacit approval, and now they're going back and saying, we didn't think that the U.S. and NATO, their military strike's going to go this far. How far do you think they're going to go? When is the last time the U.S. has gone into anything, light-handed when it comes to military? When's the last time they've chosen option, the diplomatic option? This is horrendous, people. This is absolutely horrendous. And I'm extremely mad. Peter's mad. And I hope you're mad. I hope that your head is not in the sand and you're not listening to the crap that's being put out there, the one-sided crap that's being put out there by MSNBC, obviously Fox News, ABC, CNN, and even Al Jazeera has been extremely one-sided in this. Usually you can turn to Al Jazeera and it will at least have some kind of balance, but the Al Jazeera talking heads all yesterday were basically justifying this military strike as if it was something good. All right, and this is completely based around oil reserves, the massive oil reserves that exist within Libya, more oil reserves than any other country in Africa, and it's completely based around it. But the U.S. puts this, guise on it like it's humanitarian in some shape, form, or fashion, which is total bullshit, all right? And it's a down-and-out lie, but the U.S., sheeple, suck up and follow the media here and have no critical thinking skills. They buy this stuff hook, line, and sinker. Like, oh yes, yeah, this was what we had to do. This was humanitarian. But yet, when it comes to, I'm not asking for the U.S. to intervene militarily in other places in Africa. But if it was humanitarian, you would have seen the U.S. Go ahead and intervene in Cote d'Ivoire. You might have seen them intervene in Guinea, a year ago. You might have seen them intervene, in Congo, but no, they don't. And I put it out there. It's not that I want the U.S. to have some kind of military intervention in any countries in Africa, but I'm just calling their bluff. It has nothing to do with humanitarian reasons in any shape, form, or fashion, because they customarily look over other places where. But this is the real reason. We know it has to do with oil. We know it has to do with power. And Keith Harmon Snow is going to break this down. And so Peter Fowler, co-host, he's on the line right now. Peter, we have a few more minutes before Keith Harmon Snow comes on, and I know it's going to be a very, very heavy interview that we conduct with him. But Peter, I haven't had a significant opportunity to talk to you offline about what has transpired in the last 36 hours. But so I'm going to ask you, right now on the air with all of our listeners listening, what is your take on this?
Well, first of all, I want to underscore the appropriateness of the anger that we ought to feel, that all of us ought to feel, the indignation that we must feel at this, and because the hypocrisy and the fraud of the Western imperialist and military machine is being exposed in this attack on Libya at so many different levels, and we need to look at that. Like you said, we have to dismiss what the Western media is saying in their West-toxicated perspective. I think that's one of Keith's phrases that I like so much, and even Al Jazeera. And really, when we get at the root of what's going on, it's an outrage, it's a scandal, and it's an obscenity. And especially like you mentioned, the language of humanitarian intervention is such a fraud and such a lie, that it, you know, if there weren't lives in the balance, it would be utterly laughable. But it's not laughable because of the scope and the gravity of what's really going on. But it exposes the militaristic and the imperialistic and the fraudulent ideology of particularly the United States of America, but also the entire Western capitalist apparatus in what's going on here. And I know Keith is going to help break this down a lot, but what we're seeing is you know, especially if we compare it to, you know, you mentioned some of the other African countries where humanitarian intervention might be appropriate if it were, in fact, humanitarian intervention, which it's not in Libya, obviously. But if we could just compare, all we have to say is the Palestinians. Look at what's going on. Look what the United States is supporting, the ongoing genocide of the Palestinian people. And there's no, where's the humanitarian intervention there? Look what the United States is doing to the Afghan people. Look what the United States is doing to the Iraqi people. Look at how they have, the roll call is too long to go into now, but we could just roll call around the globe over the course of the last several hundred years and look at the devastation and destruction and death wrought by the United States in country after country after country, region after region, continent after continent. And Libya, unfortunately, is just the most recent chapter in that. It has absolutely nothing to do with humanitarian intervention whatsoever. But again, as you mentioned, it's obviously about oil. It's about strategic position. You know, the United States sees these uprisings across North Africa, and it needs to regain a handle on its control in the region. And to regain to install a puppet state in Libya would be ideal for the American apparatus. So, you know, Keith is going to break this down in great detail for us, but I just wanted to put that out there, that I share your outrage, your indignation, your anger, and we need to dismiss entirely and systematically and categorically the lies by the corporate media, and really get at what's going on. And let me finish with this before we move on and get on with our interviews. The ultimate obscenity to me is we're seeing the so-called son of Africa in the White House, the one who's commenced this new war, this illegal bombing on the motherland in Africa. That is a whole nother level of obscenity to what's going on with the U.S. and Libya. So having said that,
right,
I'm looking forward to breaking it down even further with Keith.
Yeah, definitely. And thanks for that. And I want folks to know that today, just to let you know, because the corporate media is not going to pick up what I'm about to tell you. They're not going to pick it up. They'll have these buffoons, these white nationalists, Tea Partiers, whenever they have like a protest, they'll have them front and center. And it's inextricably linked to the fact that they're white. But when you have a coalition that is led by black and brown-skinned folks out there protesting war because they are for social justice, they are for peace, and they are against, you know, wars, you know, there's no media coverage. But today, at 12 noon at Lafayette Park in Washington, D.C., there was a rally that was led by the Black is Back Coalition. The Black is Back Coalition. Just go into your Google and type in Black is Back Coalition, and it'll pop right up. But there was a rally today to protest this unwarranted show of heavy-handed aggression by the U.S. and their European sycophants. And so this was led by the Black is Back Coalition. So please, you know, make sure that you go there and check it out. And if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, check it out, because there are going to be more protests and rallies to come. But I just want folks to understand that there are folks out there that are justice oriented and that are totally against this, and they're exercising their right to assemble and to protest this. And you know, I also want to let folks know, because when we get into this interview with Peter, I mean with Keith, if you haven't heard him before, he is by far one of the most comprehensive investigative journalists that I not just personally know, but whose work I've had the opportunity to really dissect and to gain a lot of information from. But if you want more information from Keith, he has a few websites, allthingspass.com, that's A-L-L, thingspass, P-A-S-S, .com. You can also go to keithharmonsnow.com, that's Keith Harmon, H-A-R-M-O-N-S-N-O-W.com. And the website where you can see many of his articles is consciousbeingalliance.com. That's consciousbeing, B-E-I-N-G, alliance.com, consciousbeingalliance.com. And you'll see several of his most recent articles. And his articles are extremely detailed. So they are lengthy because he gets into meticulous detail. And his piece on Japan, I mean, he speaks from personal experience. He spent a number of years in Japan, so studied the culture. He saw many of the nuclear reactors there. So he's going to get into this, and we're going to get into this whole notion, because as we see what's going on in Japan that was caused by this earthquake and then the following tsunami, these nuclear reactors, and this whole notion, Peter, just like when they had this whole notion that there's still looming around, that there's something called clean burning coal, which is like if there's clean burning coal, then you must also believe in the tooth fairy or Sasquatch, or the Loch Ness monster, right. one of those things, but this whole thing, Peter, about nuclear, and we know Obama just signed this, executive order, I think around a year ago, to build more nuclear reactors, and one of the locations is in Georgia. This nuclear, ask people of Chernobyl. I mean, how good it is to have a nuclear reactor in your backyard? Ask the people in Japan how it is. It's not a good idea. And we have something like 23 to 25 in this country, and we look at the ones, built, the ones that are in crisis right now in Japan. They were built by General Electric, and and if we have anything that sets one of these things off, whether it's a hurricane, a tornado, some kind of natural calamity, and that it triggers one of these nuclear reactors to start to emit radiation into the environment, Peter, it's
a blackout.
It's a wrap.
It's a blackout.
I mean, right. Peter, what are your thoughts on nuclear power, the use of nuclear power?
Like you mentioned, the clean coal rhetoric is absolutely laughable. And you're right. To believe in clean coal is to believe in the tooth fairy and in the Easter bunny and all that. It's absolute nonsense. It's an oxymoron, clean coal. It's like dry water or I don't know what, but it's insane. It's absolute insanity. You look at this unfolding Holocaust coming from Japan, and one has to really wonder what was going on, what was in the minds of people. Obviously the Japanese people are probably the most technologically and scientifically speaking second to none. In terms of their capacity and ingenuity and expertise, and yet still we see the Japanese developing how many of these nuclear reactors, and the Japanese islands sit on the Ring of Fire, the most active fault line on the planet. So I just have to ask, what were they thinking? And another irony is that we see U.S. corporations, General Electric foremost among them, being the ones who are bringing this nuclear ideology and much of the hardware to Japan with these nuclear reactors. And isn't it ironic that all this radiation of this nuclear disaster is happening where? In Japan. 60-some years after the United States dropped, the nuclear bombs on Japan, and here it is, a couple generations later, and it's repeating itself. Obviously, it's not a bomb drop from a plane, but nevertheless, it is a nuclear catastrophe in which the United States plays a large part. So it's a catastrophe on many levels, and you know, right, the U.S. bears a great deal of responsibility in that.
Yeah,
if we look at these two, you know, on the face of it, perhaps unrelated incidents on opposite sides of the globe, you know, a military intervention in Libya, and the aftermath of an earthquake and tsunami in Japan, we see there is a commonality, there is a link that jumps out at us, and it's what? Capitalism. Because the answer to the question as to why in the world would people living along the most active fault line on the planet develop nuclear power in these extremely dangerous reactors? It's about profit. You know, so capitalism, right, is the driving force in the development of nuclear power in Japan, just like it is here in the United States. And then we, right, obviously see that capitalism is at the core of this intervention, this outright attack, this assault on Libya. So,
right,
you know, if we were to boil it down, you know, we do see some clear commonalities.
Right. And with that, that's a perfect segue, Peter. I see that Keith is on the line right now, and as I said, to introduce him again, I've known Keith for, you know, close to 2 years now, and have had the opportunity to befriend him, you know, beyond just, you know, I would say just the deference that I have for his work and the time that he's put in. And folks, the reason I gave you his website is I want you to visit his website, because Keith is not backed by any corporate entity. They're not backed by the Washington Post Company or New York Times. And so he does a lot of his work with his own resources, with his own he's an independent journalist, and he needs resources. So for instance, for him to put out this information that benefits us all, to have this hardcore data, you know, within a very strong perspective, and not just regarding the story he did on Libya or the story that he did on Japan, you know, many, many other stories that he's done exposing the Kagame regime and the Museveni regime and their role that they played in the genocide in Congo, and the U.S.'s role and Walter Kanzai's, the role that you know, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton have played in the genocide in Congo. In order for him to do this work, he needs help from the community. And so I'm asking you to visit his website and peruse through his pieces. And I think after you see his pieces, if you can go to PayPal and donate, the money that you donate via the website to Keith is going right back into the movement. It allows him to do more work. It allows him to do a range of more work, to be able to travel to places and to cover things that the corporate media methodically, purposefully, is not covering and will not cover in this kind of perspective. So I just want to put that out there. Please go to allthingspass.com and consciousbeingalliance.com. And if you want to see some unbelievable pictures and footage that he's taken, you go to keithharmonsnow.com. That's keithharmonsnow.com. And we're going to have all those websites posted on our site after this interview for you to go there as well. So without further ado, I wanted to welcome once again my brother Keith Harmon-Snow to the show. Keith, are you there?
Thank you, Solomon. Hi there, and hi, Peter.
Good to have you, Keith.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Yeah, I can hear you well.
Yeah,
okay, you well. Keith, I wanted to start off with a question regarding, I guess it's so hot right now, but it's something that you called over a week ago in your piece, Genocide in Libya, NATO Invasion Underway. And you wrote this well before. This was March 1st that you posted, or March 3rd, that you posted this this story. And this is, as we know, well before this actual NATO and U.S. invasion occurred. If you could give us some kind of context to the derivation of this invasion and you know what it's all based on, because the U.S. is putting out the lie that it's humanitarian based. if you can provide some context, some truth to, you know, the genesis of this invasion and what's fueling it.
Sure. Of course, many people have followed the events in Egypt and Tunisia, where there were popular uprisings against dictatorships that have been in place for years. You know, many of us don't know anything about these places. Algeria, for example, Tunisia, Egypt, Morocco, no reporting out of North Africa. And it's very curious to look at the oil map of North Africa and see these vast concessions of oil in Libya, Algeria, Egypt, Sudan, Somalia, and not get any, and realize that there's no news about it, or that it's sort of a contradiction. The map I have is a petroleum industry map produced in 1996. It's from the industry, and it was a, you know, little coup d'etat that I was able to get a hold of it. And you look at the map of Libya and Algeria, for example, and as I say, just concession after concession, two-thirds of the country mapped out in oil concessions. And these are big countries. And you have to wonder if these are the terrorist countries that we've been led to believe. You know, my psyche for years has had this impression that Algeria and Libya are these awful terrorist countries, that, like Syria, I would be terrified to go there because, you know, they'd cut me into little pieces with their gigantic swords and the towels on their head. And before I even got off the plane, I'd be dead. You know, that's the way I've been taught to think about these countries. Well, I went to Libya in 2009 with Cynthia McKinney and a small delegation that she took to the Green Book conference there, and got to see on the inside what Libya is a little bit like, because we were only there for about a week or less, and didn't leave the hotel much because we were there for this special conference, and we weren't forced to stay in a hotel. We just didn't have time to leave very much. I did travel around the city a little bit on my own the last day and see for myself what it looked like, and I saw your typical capitalist city, a lot of construction, a lot of trash, a lot of poverty, a lot of pollution, a lot of rampant development without any concern for the environment. It looked like any other city, you know, anywhere in a certain way. And this was right on the coast, of course. Tripoli is right on the coast. And the history of Libya goes back to, you know, the American anthem, "From the Shores of Tripoli." How does it go? From the shores of Tripoli from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. Well, that's because we have a deep connection to this country, which goes way back militarily. So, for example, in 1959, oil was discovered in Libya, and Italian, French, American corporations, British companies got all over the oil. For example, one of the companies there was Exxon at the time, and another one that's out of Texas whose name is slipping me at the moment. And so by 1970, Gaddafi comes along. It was ruled by a monarchy prior to 1970, which was making sure that the U.S. and Britain and France got the oil. And then by 1970, Gaddafi comes along with what's called a popular revolution and takes control, throws out the oil companies, supposedly, nationalizes them, nationalizes the banks, and this pissed off these American oil companies hugely, you can imagine, and British as well. Curiously, Italy kept its connection there and was able to make partnerships with the national oil company and in these power-sharing agreements to continue to produce oil. Italy is a small player in the oil sector in Libya, and it's a small country considered in terms of power compared to France, Britain, or the United States. But in any case, they maintained relationships there and kept pumping the oil out throughout the Gaddafi term. And in the press today, you know, it's over, from 1970, in short, the banking and the oil were nationalized, and then the short history of Libya from then on is that the United States had a very ambiguous relationship where we had, on the one hand, CIA connections to Gaddafi, and on the other hand, Ronald Reagan, for example, sent in these Tomahawk missiles, but anyway, strike missiles back in 1986 in an attack which killed Gaddafi's adopted daughter and destroyed several bases, I believe, in Libya. I was on one of these bases and saw the bunkers that were attacked or struck in their original condition after the strike. Gaddafi never improved the conditions of these buildings, so we could see what it was like. In any case, so that's 1986. And then there's the Lockerbie bombing, the Pan Am Flight 103 that went down over Lockerbie, Scotland, which was blamed on Libya, and all these other terrorist actions which were blamed on Gaddafi, who became, throughout the 80s and 90s, this, you know, the world's premier terrorist. I mean, think of a worse terrorist, possibly Osama bin Laden, but Gaddafi's been around a lot longer. And So as we come into the 1990s, we've got an 80s, 90s, and 2001, too. We've got sanctions against Libya preventing U.S. corporations from doing business with Libya, or U.S. banks, which are also corporations, of course. And then 2001 comes along, and these buildings in New York are struck, and soon after that, Gaddafi has to jockey for control to make sure that he's not taken on by the powerful forces that have now lined up against the so-called Al-Qaeda movement and in the war on so-called war on terror. So Gaddafi makes some concessions to George Bush, the minor, and from 2004 on, we have American business deals being struck with Gaddafi in all kinds of ways, Department of Defense relationships, defense corporations, oil companies move back in quickly and set up their relationships, U.S. oil companies. But from the in the 1980s, 90s, more and more Britain and France and Korea, for example, were having more and more relationships with Gaddafi and with the oil sector. And so the United States, by 2004, they didn't really, the U.S. corporations were pissed off. They wanted a piece of the pie, and they didn't care about working with Gaddafi. And, of course, the other ones were all working with Gaddafi anyway. And then, as I said, there was a CIA relationship with Gaddafi. And then by 2004, they changed the situation. Gaddafi made some deals, and suddenly we've got this changed relationship. And Gaddafi's a wonderful guy, and Tony Blair goes over to Libya, and all these other executives go over to Libya. But Tony Blair, in particular, from Britain, he became one of Gaddafi's pimps, selling Gaddafi's ideas and organizing these big business deals, just like Blair also works for dictator in Rwanda, Paul Kagame. Do I have the right guy, Tony Blair? I could be mistaken.
Yes.
Oh, I mean, one of these British prime ministers, ex-prime ministers, has a relationship with Paul Kagame, and I can never remember which one it is, but I think it's Tony Blair.
It is Blair.
Yeah, and anyways, he has this relationship with Gaddafi, right? So then suddenly there's this little uprising in Egypt, and it spreads across, and the guys in Libya, some people in Libya, decide that they can do the same thing in Libya and get rid of Gaddafi. So the uprising that began in February, early February, mid-February, began, according to the Western media, who's always portraying Gaddafi as a terrorist and never telling us about his relationship to the CIA, for example. The media is calling Gaddafi the terrorist, and these freedom fighters in the east of the country, of Libya, are now having a sit-in, a peaceful sit-in, unarmed demonstration, which Gaddafi crushes, according to the media. And then suddenly there's this rebel group fighting back against Gaddafi who makes these huge gains in very little time in northern Libya. And that's the origin of the crisis today.
Right, right. Peter?
See if you had a question instead of just talking on and on.
No. Yeah, that's very informative. There's tremendous information. And let me reiterate something you said, just to underscore why, because, as you said, many of us, or most of us, we know little or nothing about the broader geopolitical context around northern Africa and what's going on in places like Tunisia and Egypt and Libya. And obviously, there's some intentionality behind that in terms of keeping people dumb and not knowing what's going on. And so along those lines, Keith, could you talk, you mentioned obviously Muammar Gaddafi, and could you talk a little bit about how he has been, how and why he's been demonized by the Western press, as opposed to his personality and the way he's perceived outside of the West, in North Africa and throughout Africa. Could you talk a little bit about that and what that means in terms of what's going on today?
Sure, there's an entire, entire discourse, an entire many perspectives. It's not a single perspective. It's this group of perspectives that exist beyond what I gave as a simple explanation. Me being a white guy, it's difficult for me to understand some of the different aspects of this, which revolve around people of Arab descent, people of color, and people of African descent, Africans, for example, versus African Americans. Which, what I'm getting at here is that, for example, there's a deep relationship between Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam and Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. And Cynthia McKinney, for example, there was a reason she was invited over to Libya as a delegate for the Green Conference versus, any other African-American senator or congressperson. And you have to ask, what is the relationship of these different groups to Gaddafi? And he seemed as a true revolutionary. He came to power, of course, throughout the United States and Britain, et cetera, in 1969, 1970. Oh, and I didn't mention that, you know, just north of Tripoli, northeast of Tripoli, is a massive former U.S. air base. And this was incredibly important to the United States during the Cold War, meaning, and World War II. Of course, the Germans at one point controlled it also, but World War II, after World War II, in 1950s, 1960s, up until 1970, this was the U.S.'s number one base for all kinds of covert surveillance operations, strike operations in Vietnam, and bombing missions out of which would needed refueling out of Libya. And the base also was served as a site for U.S. missile testing. So they launched and tested missiles there in the desert. And I'm sure that it's extremely toxic, and no one's ever done a story about the kind of toxicity that probably exists in the desert there. But anyway, this, you know, this part about U.S. missile testing in northern Libya before Gaddafi is very much unknown. And there were thousands and thousands, like I think it was 4,000 or 3,600 U.S. personnel on this military base when Gaddafi took over the country. So, again, the U.S. was very pissed off about that. But getting back to the Pan-African side, of course, if people don't know this, Pan-African is considered to be Kwame Nkrumah from Ghana and Patrice Lumumba. These were Pan-Africanists. They were people... I'm not even sure how to describe the Pan-African movement. It might be better if Solomon, if you did that. But the bottom line is that you've got, again, these large groups of people in the mostly what we call the third world or in the underprivileged classes in the United States who find Gaddafi or believe Gaddafi to be this revolutionary and have relationships with him. In some cases are simply purely financial, and in other cases are more ideological in that they believe in and adhere to the Green Book and it's the principles of the Green Book, which was written by Gaddafi. And this is like Mao Zedong's little Red Book, or Fidel Castro, I think, wrote some little tract too, or something that might have come out of Che Guevara. But the Green Book is a very interesting read, and it says all the right things from my perspective on what we should do to stop this capitalist juggernaut from destroying the planet. Now, whether or not, the question is, did Gaddafi actually adhere to the Green Book, or is he just... You know, did he produce it in the 1970s, and then what's he done since? And the truth seems to be that he's worked with the capitalist system all along, and at the same time, he's funded all these dissident groups and liberation movements, and some groups that are called, you know, movements that are called liberation movements that have nothing to do with liberation. For example, in the 1980s, Gaddafi had close relationships with groups in Sudan that were fighting against the U.S. puppet in Sudan, the CIA guy, President Nimeri, who was in charge in Sudan for at least 15 years, and thrown out in 1985. So in the early 80s, you had these groups that in Sudan were fighting with Libya, fighting against, you know, low-intensity conflict against the government of Sudan, which was a U.S. puppet state. And at the same time in Sudan, you had U.S.-backed factions, which were rebels that were fighting against Gaddafi. And it turns out some of these rebels are the same, very same CIA-backed rebels that are in eastern Libya today fighting against the regime that the press has called freedom fighters. But back to your question is, how is Gaddafi perceived? He's perceived to be a revolutionary. He's deeply trusted or believed in by many, many, many people of the African-American descent in the United States and Arab descent in the world. And some of these relationships I can't really get into very well because I don't understand them. For example, Louis Farrakhan, although I can say that Farrakhan has received a lot of money from Gaddafi. He tried to bring a gift of $1 billion into the United States from Gaddafi, and the U.S. Department of Treasury would not allow that. And, you know, the money that comes in through Farrakhan is used to fund some of the mosques that are part of the Nation of Islam. But that's a very deep ideological discussion of which I'm not prepared to get into. In other words, who is Louis Farrakhan, and what is the Nation of Islam, and is it reactionary, is it revolutionary, is it counter-revolutionary, is he a CIA man? I mean, there's all these questions about that. But the bottom line is you've got these relationships to Gaddafi that go back to the question of who is Muammar Gaddafi really? And I think at the end of the day, you look at these rebel groups fighting against him, you look at who Gaddafi is in his country, how he's perceived by the people, what he's done for the people. The claims by the people that love Gaddafi are that Gaddafi has raised the standard of living in Libya significantly. It's a country of only about 6 million people, and that's fairly small. I mean, we've got U.S. cities that are bigger than that. And it's a gigantic, geographically gigantic desert country. And then, you know, for example, in some of the more remote parts of Libya, there are certainly massive underground mineral concessions that the West seeks to gain control of. And these would include uranium, because remember, just across the border in Niger is the uranium nuclear security complex, which brings us into the subject of nuclear power and nuclear reactors. But the nuclear security complex of France, I mean, France's entire nuclear missiles and nuclear power sector was built out of the uranium coming out of Niger, which today is the second poorest country in the world, just south of Libya. So back to the point, there's all these mines in Libya that the capitalist system seeks to gain control of. And why is Gaddafi, on the one hand, allowed to fight back against the rebels for the last 2 weeks? And who are the rebels? Those are big questions. And then suddenly, why is NATO launching airstrikes against Gaddafi? And how can NATO have the authority or the legitimacy to do this? These are big questions.
Right. I was just watching this morning. It was MSNBC and that garble that was put out there, like one set of garbled, and they had this so-called expert. And I was wondering if you could put in perspective, you could school us and our listeners in terms of the background surrounding the Lockerbie bombing, because this guy came on and he's like, This is warranted, you know. Gaddafi's a tyrant. He's like, and just look at the fact that, you know, that he was responsible. He was solely responsible for downing the Pan Am flight over Lockerbie, Scotland, and you know, many folks have exposed that the CIA was perhaps connected to that. If you could give us some context in terms of this. What was surrounding that, and then also the subsequent bombing that that took the life of Gaddafi's daughter by Ronald Reagan when he bombed Libya, I believe it was 84 or 85.
Sure. To point out for your listeners and yourself, if you're not aware of this, I'm 51 years old, so I was born in 1960, which was about the time of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. So here we are in 2011, and, you know, there's all these legitimate conspiracies in the world where someone's been assassinated. We can give a long list of assassinations from Thomas Sankara, which most of your listeners may never have heard of, who's out of Burkina Faso, which is right next to Libya, and involves Israel, and involves the CIA guy that went to Harvard University who ran the show in Liberia for so many years, Charles Taylor. And what I'm getting at here is that the Lockerbie bombing in 1986, the shooting down of the plane, the Pan Am 103 flight, is another conspiracy event that you could dedicate your entire life to and never, and perhaps come to some conclusions that are very legitimate and perhaps never really understand what's going on, depending on what you chose to read and what you were able to find. So, for example, I'm back to the subject of the assassination of Kennedy. I'm reading a fantastic book about the assassination of Kennedy, and it's taken me my entire life to get to the point where I can actually read and understand and make the connections that this book is talking about. And so I don't have the deeper story on the Lockerbie bombing, but there is evidence, and there are people that have done significant research who say that there was a group of former CIA or former special forces that formed an organization called Interforce in the United States. And this Interforce organization was hired by some of the victims, I believe it was the victims of the Pan Am flight bombing, to find out what really happened. And they determined that it was a CIA operation to bring down the Pan Am flight, to blame it on Muammar Gaddafi, but it had something deeply connected to the loss of some, also the loss of some U.S. CIA assets in Jordan. So it's a very complicated little story, but we can sum it up by saying there's a big question about whether Muammar Gaddafi had anything at all to do with the Lockerbie bombing, and the conclusion seemed to be that he did not. And at the same time, there's plenty of other examples of absolute terrorism that have been committed on the planet that evidence suggests that Muammar Gaddafi was connected to. And that would bring up this whole question of this former CIA guy, Edwin P. Wilson, who ended up in prison in the United States because of his relationship working as an ex-CIA officer with Gaddafi. And what he did was he was selling weapons and selling clothing and armaments to Gaddafi through CIA front companies that he set up in Florida. This is in the 1970s, right after Gaddafi came to power in 1969, 1970. So it's not like we can say, well, you know, that was in Gaddafi's later years. This is in his so-called revolutionary years. And, you know, that it seems that this Edwin P. Wilson case with the CIA, that this guy ended up in prison in the United States, and he was the fall guy. So Wilson was this American former CIA agent, was the fall guy, and it basically covered up the deeper connection to the CIA, where they stood back and said, you know, plausible denial. We had nothing to do with that. This guy was operating as a rogue agent on his own, working with Gaddafi, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the evidence seems to suggest that Wilson was working with the CIA through these front companies, and he had direct CIA contacts, and he was selling and weaponry in through Libya. And then Gaddafi's people or somebody, organizations from Libya, were going out and committing these acts of terrorism. And at the same time, Wilson was bringing in former U.S. special forces that may also have been still on the payroll of the Department of Defense. And they were training these, what became known as terrorist forces in Libya, who also went out and committed atrocities that are documented and believed to be actually committed by people from Libya under Gaddafi's control or in relationship to Gaddafi. And then you've got, you know, plenty of evidence of plenty of situations where Gaddafi had nothing to do with it, just like Cuba, Fidel Castro had nothing to do with it, and just like other people who were assassinated, like Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, had nothing to do with some of the claims that were made against him, just to make him look bad and therefore justify perpetrating atrocities against him, or in the case of Lumumba, assassinating him. And so with Gaddafi, they want to paint him as a terrorist. Meanwhile, he is our terrorist. And this brings up the question of these Islamic fundamentalists, radical Islamists who, during the Cold War, during the 1970s and 1980s, and we can think of some obvious examples, a group called the Taliban. And these Islamic fundamentalists were trained in Saudi Arabia by the United States to do the dirty work of the United States during the Cold War. And again, back to the Taliban, fighting against the communist Afghanistan dictator, whatever. Communist, I'm not going to say dictatorship in Afghanistan, but communist rule in Afghanistan prior to 1999. And so in amidst the groups that are fighting against Gaddafi since February 20th of this year, we've got these Islamic fundamentalists who really have nothing to do with Islam per se, because they adhere to an extremist terrorist ideology. They have completely corrupted any sense of what the Quran is really about. And they pop up all over the world where there are these terrorist operations going down that, in the end, seem to serve America's interests. So this group shows up, and they're one of the factions fighting against Gaddafi, along with these rebels under a group called the Front for the National Salvation of Libya, the FNSL. And that's the group that was trained in Sudan by the CIA in the 1980s. So there's two elements of the so-called popular uprising in Libya today. Another element of the popular uprising in Libya are the genuine dissidents and the genuine populace who are genuinely, popularly rising up. And that would be the truly revolutionary component that wants to throw Gaddafi out because he has not done what it's claimed that he's done for the country, because he created his private militias, because he does not have control of the Libyan army. And these groups knew that he didn't have control of the Libyan army and believed that they could get Libyan officials, Libyan military, to defect, join the rebel cause, which they did in early February, and fight against Gaddafi, who, without a military, was weak. And so February 20th through March 1st, you saw these so-called rebel groups being advertised by the Western press as freedom fighters fighting against this absolute terrorist. Meanwhile, again, you know, in the back door, Tony Blair and Madeleine Albright and Hillary Clinton have these connections to Gaddafi. And so these guys start fighting against him, and the press is calling them freedom fighters, but they don't tell us who the Front for the National Salvation of Libya is, and they don't tell us. They just tell us that the people are fighting back against Gaddafi. Another piece of the people fighting back against Gaddafi piece is the National Endowment for Democracy, and this is a CIA organization created under something I think it was called the Democracy Act, Project Democracy, back in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan. And this is total CIA, but it's transparent, meaning the CIA created a bureau, effectively a bureau of the CIA, which is overt rather than covert. CIA, which is small compared to the National Security Agency, by the way, the CIA is covert and the NSA is covert, and then you've got this overt group, which the NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, and all of its four major subgroups that work in countries like Mongolia or Korea, South Korea, or Libya. And they're in Libya. They've been funding these groups in Libya, and they fund these groups in Egypt, and they fund these groups in the Congo, who are the National Endowment for Democracy puts this innocent Western humanitarian face on covert operations, which means that they're involved in negotiations, alliances with the people that are bringing in the weapons. They're involved in the creation of black propaganda. Black propaganda, there's several different kinds of propaganda. What we have now, you know, me speaking is a form of propaganda, but I try to be honest, and that's not considered black propaganda. So black propaganda is one of their missions, and so-called freedom of the press. So they create alternative radio stations and alternative press stations that in some places the dictatorship will crush. And so they've been doing this, pumping thousands and thousands and thousands and millions of dollars into Libya through the NED in the last roughly 10 years. So these are the different pieces of the opposition, what we would call opposition in Libya. And to summarize what people are finding it difficult to understand is, Gaddafi is an agent of the West. He's served the powerful interests of the West while at the same time funding and supporting different groups in the world who are challenger groups to the capitalist system, which gives him this appeal and this sense of legitimacy. And at the same time, he's been an absolute brutal military dictator. Of course, he's not nearly as bad as some other brutal military dictators in the world, some of them who have been doing these short house sits in a place called the White House. And so Gaddafi is this capitalist agent who's been making sure that we get what we want and keeping the country under control for 40 years. Anybody who lasts for 40 years is a dictator. You know, it's clear. And then these guys challenge him on February 20th, and the rebel movement starts to get momentum because Gaddafi's not expecting it, and he has militias. So he has to bring in mercenaries to fight for him, and the rebels get the support of the Western system through covert forces that go in, British covert forces, American covert forces, American strike force, aircraft carrier off the coast, different pieces of the puzzle that are put in place as early as March 3rd. And then the U.S., the West backs off because they know that if they support the rebels and attack Gaddafi, all of these revolutionary pan-African, African-American groups outside are going to see Gaddafi as the hero who's being attacked by the brutal Western imperialists. And they won't be able to achieve their mission. So they let the rebels move against Gaddafi, their former agent. Gaddafi brings in his mercenaries, starts fighting back and crushing the rebel movement, which is not, in some cases, legitimate, but is backed by the West. And then the U.S. stands back and says, oh, that nasty man. We have to stop this awful war and bring peace and democracy to the world. Of course, we're tied up in Afghanistan and we're tied up in Iraq, but we have to change the regime. This is what they're saying today on CNN. Regime change in Libya. And that's what's going on. And having created the conditions where the U.S. has convinced the American public prior to 2004 that Gaddafi is the absolute terrorist, it's very easy to get the American public to not say anything at all about sending in 110 Tomahawk missiles to bomb innocent people in Libya as well as defense positions, which in the end will be the places where the U.S. Department of Defense and all of our big multinational corporations are able to sell new weaponry.
Right. Keith, you've said a lot there helping us unpack this. Could you talk a little bit about, you mentioned regime change, right?
Yeah.
That language obviously has been part of the public discourse for several years now, you know, going back to Saddam Hussein and so forth. But if it's my understanding that the UN resolution was very clear that regime change is not a part of what the UN was agreeable to, so essentially it would be illegal. Obama has kind of prevaricated on that, while Hillary Clinton has pretty much said that's what she'd like to see. Sarkozy has talked about it. So could you talk a little bit about that language and that piece of what's going on? And then also you talked about a lot of the different groups, Al-Qaeda, a lot of the Islamist groups and Taliban and so forth. And you know, we read this morning about some of the strikes hitting these so-called rebel capital city of Benghazi and the rebel stronghold of Misrata. Who are the rebels that the Western media refers to? What should we know about that? And who are they referring to when they talk about rebels? Who are they? So what's really going on there? How can we make sense of what we're hearing?
Thanks, Peter. It was supposed to be a short summary of the to bring people up to speed on the different pieces of the puzzle about understanding Libya, and I forgot to add the most important part at the end, and that is, by hook or by crook, by terrorist operation, by assassination, massacre, or using unmanned aerospace vehicles, drones, to strike, the United States wants to crush and destroy any popular revolution, any popular uprising across North Africa and the Arab world, which is what we're seeing. In Libya, this means crushing the popular uprising, not supporting the rebels, which is why people are confused, because in the beginning we did support these rebels and we supported the peace of the rebels that are a popular peace. But in the end, Gaddafi has marched against them. He's done his damage against the rebels now, which is perfect for the United States and Britain. And so now we're going to attack Gaddafi. But in the end, these popular forces, the people of Libya, will find that the United States and Britain and France and Italy and our Korean and formerly Japanese partners are the ones in control in another form of military dictatorship in Libya. So to answer your question, I did discuss a little bit about the different rebel groups, aspects of the rebels, and I see three key parts. One is genuine dissidents, genuine people, innocent civilians, formerly who are uprising against the Gaddafi regime, who are legitimately concerned about freedom, peace, democracy, truth, and self-autonomy. And those would include some of Gaddafi's military who defected. Gaddafi's, not his militias, which are private militias which have controlled the country, but rather government forces which have been kept weak, because they're kept weak so there won't be a coup d'etat against Gaddafi. So some of them have defected. They're part of the rebel structure. Then you've got the National Front for the Salvation of Libya and its connections right out of Britain. They had a meeting, for example, in 2004 where they organized a big conference in Britain. And prior to that also, the Front for the National Salvation of Libya has had conferences in the United States. So this is the CIA-backed group, originally CIA-backed, who was armed and trained in northwestern Sudan, basically the Darfur region, back in the 1980s to fight against Gaddafi from Sudan across Chad. And then the last piece of the rebel groups, as far as I can understand, and of course none of this is set in stone, we're all doing our best, Gaddafi has these people, these Islamic radicals, these proxy forces that were backed by the West during the Cold War, who are also participating now against Gaddafi, which is both useful to the United States because they attack Gaddafi and create a scenario where the West can justify attacking Gaddafi also, because Gaddafi fights back. And in the end, these guys also will be picked up and moved somewhere else for the U.S.'s imperialist, you know, covert operations, perhaps Libya, perhaps back to Egypt, perhaps to Syria, for example, or Saudi Arabia, which could be these could be the next fronts of some, you know, massive popular uprising. And the double standards are notable because in Bahrain and Egypt, you have truly popular uprisings where the U.S. has not called in anyone to stop the killing there, but we've called in NATO and these Taban missiles to destroy Gaddafi. So that's and of course the double standards are much deeper than that. Paul Kagame and Yoweri Museveni down in Rwanda and Uganda respectively, these dictators have committed atrocities on the scale of 10 to 12 to 15 million dead.
Right.
Kagame and Museveni came to power with British backing and U.S. backing from 1979 to 1985 in Uganda. They jointly worked together to march in and take over Rwanda from 1990 to 1994. We called it genocide. We created the International Criminal Tribunal to try the losers who are not responsible for genocide in Rwanda. And then, of course, Kagame and Museveni, backed by the Pentagon, and we're talking C-130s, covert forces, U.S. officials like USAID, which is a CIA front, USAID officials like Brian Atwood and others, who marched into the Congo and took over the Congo. And so jointly, from 1980 to the present, Museveni and Kagame have run the show in Central Africa to the tune of somewhere between 10 million dead in Congo, 2 million dead in Uganda at least, and, you know, 1 to 2 million dead in Rwanda. So the double standards here are extreme. And Kagame's weak. I mean, sorry. They know that Gaddafi is weak, and that's why they're able to move against him. But the question is, will there be organizations that, or governments, or other groups that back Gaddafi and bring this up to the scale of an insurgency like we have where we're dug in Afghanistan in a very illegitimate war, or in Iraq in a very illegitimate war on the part of the United States and Britain? I hope that answered your question.
Yes, but yeah,
big time. Keith, I wanted to ask you a question as we start to make the transition to your other piece, and I'm glad you gave that strong contextual overview connecting Kagame and Museveni. You know, and what a lot of folks don't know is, you know, these military operations like Operation Thunder Lightning that executed in I believe Uganda, and you know the huge benefits in terms of this reciprocity, this relationship that Kagame, who was nothing short of a brutal human being, along with Museveni, who has tons of blood on his hands, more blood than I believe Idi Amin ever had, and their relationship with the U.S. Now, the U.S. never refers to them for what they really are, and it's because of their relationship. My question for you, after that picture that you drew is, what if this invasion continues to go as planned from the U.S. perspective? What can we expect? And obviously from a negative perspective, because it would be negative. What can we expect to see slowly emerging within the U.S. in terms of because I like the part in your article where you got to the part where it says it's not only the oil, stupid, and you started to expose and name Canada's Barrick Gold, and to expose former Canadian Prime Minister Brian Mulroney and these huge gold and other mineral concessions in Niger and Mali, which you mentioned a few minutes ago. What can we see? What kind of state will Libya become? Will it will it start to emerge like we saw after Iraq, where after Iraq we saw the huge privatization of all these different oil reserves, these no bid contracts given to the likes of Exxon and Chevron and BP. What kind of danger? What are we looking at if this continues as planned?
It's to some degree speculation, of course, but I'll do my best. Algeria is a gigantic country, and it's a gigantic Islamic country, and it's, of course, it has a deep history of relationships to France and the United States, which are very repressive. The Algerian liberation struggle back in the 1950s, 60s, etc. What happens with Libya versus with respect to Algeria is completely an unknown today. I think Algeria is currently backing Gaddafi to some degree, but they also know, they must know that, it looks like Gaddafi's days are numbered. So it seems to me like Gaddafi's going down. Gaddafi's out. It seems to me. However, even if Gaddafi's out or if he isn't, regardless, there could be a very protracted war against imperialist forces setting up in Libya. And this could come from legitimate groups that are unhappy about the capitalist system having expropriated their entire lives and their families and their land forever, such as the Tuareg people. Tuareg people are these people who wear these saffron robe. Saffron, is that the, I'm confused, the bright purple robes that ride on camels. They're one of the nomadic groups in the desert. The Tubus and the Tuaregs are the big nomadic groups who didn't know any boundaries until the U.S., the West came along and carved up Libya and created Niger, Libya, Mauritania, Burkina Faso, which was Upper Volta, and Mali. These are the big countries, and Algeria, big countries where you find the Tuaregs. They used to move across these horizontal belts. They're fighting against France and the United States currently in northern Niger. The disaffection for the United States and the uranium mining in Niger is huge, and that's why we have covert operations bases in Niger, where we have U.S. Special Operations Forces training what's been called America's African Rifles. And so whether there are groups that fight against the United States and Britain after we gain control of Libya, or whether it becomes whether we act, you know, the question is, if the United States gave any sense of true control to the true people of Libya, perhaps these external forces would leave it alone and it would become a peaceful country. However, the United States doesn't do that. We don't ever give control to the people. And the goal now is to crush any popular uprising in Libya. And so it's hard to say what will happen there. You asked about the UN, or mentioned, Peter, the UN, and the UN sanctions say no regime change, et cetera, or the UN declaration against Libya, you know, clearly no regime change. But we all know, or some of us, or we'd like more of us to know, that the United Nations is a tool of the United States, which is why you have the International Criminal Court and the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia, and the International Criminal Tribunal for Sierra Leone, which are all created by and for and with the United States and NATO to serve the interests of the victor, of the empire. And so you have 6 or 7 black Africans on trial at the International Criminal Court, when we know perfectly well who some of the biggest war criminals are involved in the killing in the Congo for the last 50 years. And, for example, Maurice Teppelspan out of New York. Maurice Teppelspan was very close to the Kennedy family and was the lover of Jackie Kennedy Onassis. He set up diamond cartels and cobalt cartels coming out of Zaire, which became the Democratic Republic of Congo under Mobutu, and he maintained this for years. And he still has his diamond cartels connected to De Beers and Israel. And this is where the big money and the big power is, and which comes into play when we talk about Libya, because Libya, of course, has given the appearance of being hostile to Israel and vice versa. Some people claim, there's a book out there that they claim tells the story of how the Mossad brought, which is this, you know, effectively the CIA for Israel, brought Gaddafi to power to serve the interests of Israel and the United States. And you have to ask, you know, how do these relationships maintain themselves for so long, whereby the oil continues to flow out of Libya and Gaddafi maintained 40 years of dictatorship when if he has these forces so powerful against him like Israel and the United States? It comes back to the issue that he actually has been a tool of the powerful Western forces. But regime change is the goal. Regime change is the goal. Put in a new regime with a democratic face, with all this money by the National Endowment for Democracy, and serves U.S. interests and make it look like it's freedom and democracy and truth and human rights and all that other nonsense that we like to perpetuate.
Right. Keith, where do you see, and I didn't want to be remiss in asking you, there's something that's been on my mind for some time. If you could give us an update in terms of what is the status of affairs within Congo and especially in the northeast Kivu region, what's the status of that? The last time you were on my show, we spent a great deal of time dissecting Congo and some of the players that have played a major role in the plunder and the mass genocide within the Congo. What's the current status of affairs within Congo?
Well, it's in whiteout as far as the press on one level, and which means we're not getting anything about it. The crisis in Japan legitimately deserves a lot of press coverage. Libya has taken an unequal share. And, of course, most of the American media and most of the American people have been more concerned about Charlie Sheen and his 2.5 boys TV show, sitcom, lawsuit against NBC. So back to the Congo, it's in whiteout. What's going on there hasn't changed much from the last time I was on. Probably, I would say, I haven't seen a report lately about the death toll, but, it, you know, on the order of 1,000 people a day were dying in eastern Congo. It was 1,600 last time I was on your show. And the war there, the conflict there, hasn't changed except that AFRICOM, which is the Pentagon's wing of AFRICOM, is the African wing of the Pentagon's control of Africa. And AFRICOM has entrenched itself more deeply in the Congo through Rwanda and Uganda. There's been an election in Uganda, which was a completely sold-out election. And you should have on a guy named Andrei Glicek, who's a Eastern European, I can't think which country he's from, Croatian. And he's a great leftist journalist who would tell you something. He's been working in Uganda and Rwanda, and he's been there during the elections, I believe. And so Museveni has brought himself to power once again, you know, dictator for life, after he came to power in 1985, so whatever number of years that is. 21, I think. And in the Congo, there was a coup attempt against Joseph Kabila, who's the U.S. man in the Congo. And, you know, this goes all back to Gaddafi, because Gaddafi has funded and armed and trained some of the so-called liberation groups in the Congo, for example. And this is an example of the hypocrisy of Pan-African forces by saying, who say that Gaddafi is a wonderful, you know, force for the African people. First of all, he was the chairman of the African Union most recently, and still is technically, but, and that means that he served with a bunch of absolute dictators on the African Union who make sure that the West gets what it wants out of Africa, and it doesn't serve the people in any sense of the word. And the other dictators, for example, you know, they are some of the worst human rights violators on the planet, like George Bush and Bill Clinton. I don't want to ever say that Africans are human rights violators without mentioning the people that work with them and back them and support them and arm them and are responsible for larger, you know, larger scale atrocities. But getting back to Gaddafi in Congo, he backed Jean-Pierre Bemba, one of the rebel factions, the Movement for the Liberation of Congo, which was also aligned or backed by Museveni. There we have Gaddafi and Museveni, both fight from Uganda, both backing the Liberation of Congo movement, who was responsible for a very clear genocide in the Congo. Comparatively, it's difficult to say that Gaddafi is responsible for genocide in Libya. I mean, that's why I put a question mark after genocide in Libya, because the media picks it up and people start proclaiming that Gaddafi, they were proclaiming Gaddafi was committing genocide as early as March 5th, I believe. And there were, you know, there's no evidence that this is a genocide if we apply the technical term genocide as it's known by the United Nations. What we have is a political economy of genocide, like in the Congo. So some places are labeled genocide because we want to demonize the people that are there, the people that are fighting against our interests or disturbing our interests or pissing on our feet or whatever. And the other places that legitimate dictators are responsible for genocide, we give them awards, like Bill Clinton's relationship to Paul Kagame. So back to the Congo, you know, basically Eastern Congo is a wreck. And the most significant thing that happened recently was the U.S. hearing in Washington recently, congressional hearing organized by some Congolese groups and the and some religious groups in the United States who want something done about the Congo. And it was basically taken over by corporate interests. And at one hearing, there wasn't a single non-white, not a single African who spoke. And the people that did speak are the people that are working as front organizations to try to derail the Free Congo movement. But you did have Ben Affleck come in the next day and give an amazing speech that people should listen to, because, I mean, it's right out of the, if you remember Ben Affleck in the Matt Damon film Good Will Hunting, where Matt Damon sends his agent to speak to these guys in a corporate boardroom about a possible job offer, and Ben Affleck plays the role of this ignorant South Boston kid who goes in there and screws them over for $30. Well, it's exactly what he sounded like when he talked before the U.S. Congress. It's all he could do to keep from breaking out into laughter. It was absolute nonsense.
Right. Okay. Yeah, Keith, I mean, we could talk all day and just have you go on. But I want to transition now, if we could, to something catastrophic has happened on the other side of the planet, obviously referring to Japan and what's going on there. And, you know, there are some commonalities, even though the apparent differences in these debacles, one of them being what you refer to as the psychopathology of denial or delusion that's preeminent in the West. And apparently, what's really going on in Japan, specifically having to do with the nuclear reactors and so forth in the wake of the earthquake and the tsunami, are far from what's being revealed through the Western media. So, first, by all means, if you want to add anything by way of wrap up, you know, to the conversation on Northern Africa, please do. But also, then, if we could transition into Japan and talk a little bit about what's really going on in Japan.
Sure. Can you just clue me in? How much time do we have left so I can know how to frame it?
We have at least 30 minutes left.
Great. Okay. Well, just to close out the African subject, I talked about Ben Affleck speaking before Congress. And what I didn't mention was that Affleck has set up this so-called humanitarian organization in Eastern Congo. And he goes in there and he gets all this press. And, of course, they ran his testimony before Congress live, which they didn't do for the African people who spoke on the same day, which was the second day of the hearings. As I said, one day there were no Africans. The next day there were some Africa Faith and Justice group, I think, spoke, network, and also perhaps Friends of the Congo. But in any case, Affleck spoke, and they ran it, you know, webcasted live. And people should watch that because it's absolute nonsense. And when they do, remember that Affleck is making money off of the bodies of the Congolese and the Rwandan people. He has a direct economic relationship, a business relationship in Rwanda, and he has the audacity to go into the Eastern Congo. And remember that the biggest problem for Eastern Congo is Paul Kagame and Yoweri Museveni, and they're sending in troops and manipulating the situation there with the backing of and the support of and the direct participation of AFRICOM. So if we wanted to talk about what's going on in Japan, we got 30 minutes. So also in the Eastern Congo, you had this guy named Anderson Cooper who went in and did some reporting. And Cooper went into the hot zone and, you know, like Affleck, when he spoke publicly on the media, he's absolute nonsense. Doesn't tell you about these guys behind the mining from the West, like the white guys, not the black guys, not Kagame and Museveni, but the guys that are behind Kagame and Museveni. And so Anderson Cooper, 360 is his program, Anderson Cooper 360. He's this very posh-looking, very suave-looking white guy with white hair who goes into the Congo, does the story, doesn't tell you anything, gets all this coverage, and they of course, he's the hero. He's the white Tarzan. The story is about him. It's about his exploits in the Congo, you know? So he goes to Japan. He shows up in Japan a few days ago, and he's reporting from the north, from Kensai, from Sendai, and he hears this explosion, and he's live, and he's reporting live, and he hears this explosion of one of these nuclear plants, and he says to the guy who he's talking to, who he's interviewing, who's from Boston, Massachusetts, a nuclear expert, you know, filling us in about what we need to think about, how we need to think, basically, about the nuclear apocalypse coming down in Japan right now. And the nuclear expert, they don't tell you who he is. They give you his name, but they don't tell you what he does or where he's from. And he's talking, and suddenly Anderson Cooper says, wait a minute, the subtext here, he interrupts the guy and talks under him. He says, should I get out of here? Suddenly Anderson Cooper wakes up to the fact of radiation. And he basically runs for his life. But first he says to the guy, should I get out of here? And the guy on the other end, who's an MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, basically a CIA front for the nuclear power industry forever, this guy says, he laughs. And he laughs at Anderson for being afraid suddenly. And he says, no, don't worry, you know, you don't have to worry. I'm going to err on the side of conservatism here, Anderson, because I don't want you to come back and sue me, but you're okay. Don't worry about it. And Anderson was like, wait a minute. He suddenly woke up, and he left Japan, basically. And the media has pulled out. NBC has pulled its media out of Japan because of the radiation poisoning. This is very significant. CNN is Anderson Cooper, but he pulled out. And he's now reporting on Libya, and I can't tell where he's reporting from because it's not Libya, but there's a background city that looks like it might be Seoul or Hong Kong, or it could even be Tokyo, but I don't think so. I think it's probably Hong Kong, maybe even Europe. And so the point is, media, on one hand, forever, meaning since the beginning of the nuclear weapon conflict in 1936, has told us that the atom is for people's peaceful purposes. There's no radiation to worry about. And if there is anything that looks like it's alarming, like, for example, small leak at Vermont Yankee yesterday, no public threat. I mean, that's what they say. In this very same sentence, they'll say there was a radiation leak. Officials have taken these steps, but they tell us that there's nothing to worry about. This is such an absolute lie that it's criminal. So the media now has pulled out of Japan because of the radiation, and today they're reporting, they've got a CNN report, which is completely horrible, what you'd call criminal. The title is Facts Whisper. In other words, the facts people don't hear, but fears scream during a crisis. And they go on to tell you how radiation is not a problem at all, but we're really afraid of it for no good reason. It's called radiophobia. So I just published a story about this. It's a very short one on my website. And I published it actually the minute I should have been calling you, which is why I was 3 minutes late. And what I want to get to here is the media tells us one thing, and at the same time, it's very, very deadly. This is one of the worst crises that has ever hit the human race.
We're talking about six reactors at the Fukushima complex, plus two reactors to the south and one reactor to the north, which also had some problems. But the six Fukushima reactors were built by GE, Hitachi, Hitochi. Those are two different companies, Hitachi, Hitochi, GE, and they're run by TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Corporation. And when the earthquake hit and the tsunami followed, the shit hit the fan in Japan. And it's hitting it now. And it is not, we're talking about the epicenter of massive radiation. And when people read radiation leaks, they should think twice. Radiation does not leak. It explodes. It disperses. It radiates. It emits. It's like a little, imagine holding a sun, an invisible sun in your hand. If you've got a particle of plutonium that's gotten on your body, kill you instantly. But it's radiating energy, gamma and beta and alpha rays that you can't see. It's odorless and it's colorless. But we call it leaks. These aren't leaks. What's going on in Japan are massive, massive emissions where these reactors have partially melted down or possibly completely melted down. And we were told from the very beginning, which was Friday of last week, Friday, I think it was March 11th, when the accident, when the natural disaster occurred, we were told consistently in the beginning that, sure, there's been a little problem with this nuclear plant, but nothing to worry about. Nothing to worry about. Okay, so then finally, there's a little bit of a radiation problem here. Nothing to worry about. Japanese officials say nothing to worry about. The United States backed this up. The United States media backed this up. They reported nothing to worry about, but they were not reporting what the Japanese said so much as covering up the truth. In other words, we are deeply aligned with the Japanese in the production and creation of nuclear waste, nuclear power, and nucleated fuel rods in Japan. This is the United States. It's not Japan. It just happens that these reactors are sited in Japan. The Japanese can run technology to the precision, profound precision. The Shinkansen, for example, the bullet train in Japan, exceeds speeds up to 580 kilometers per hour, which is about 360 miles an hour. Ever ride Amtrak?
Yes.
We're talking about serious knowledge of technical issues. If the Japanese can't do it, nobody can do it. And these plants have now gone into different states of meltdown. Three different reactors that were running at the time of the tsunami, and three reactors that were downloaded were offline at the time of the tsunami. But all six reactors have a spent fuel pool. And the spent fuel pool is perhaps more of a concern than the reactors themselves. I'll take
right.
a break there.
Yeah, that's so what? Could you connect this to? I mean, you connected to the U.S. You know, with mentioning, you know, General Electric and the information that MSNBC and CNN had in terms of, you know, why they moved their folks away from Japan to someplace else, perhaps Korea, South Korea. What's the deeper connection? Because we know that Obama, you know, last year, you know, signed a nuclear energy deal where there's going to be some building of nuclear reactors in Georgia. And I believe there's like 23 or 25 in the U.S. You know, there's one close by where you are. In Massachusetts, I believe the Vermont, I forget the name of the Vermont
Yankee
power plant. What kind of Keith? There's a lot of talk right now, and there has been a lot of talk that, you know, nuclear energy, it's safe, it's clean, and this is you know, one of the alternative means of energy that the U.S. needs to be you know, strongly looking at and supporting within the U.S. borders. What's the truth regarding the so-called safety of nuclear energy, and what kind of ramifications could we look at if something were to happen at one of the reactors within the U.S., maybe the Vermont Yankee power plant?
Yeah, so there you bring up one of the biggest lies of the nuclear power industry, of the nuclear reactor, nuclear weapons complex. Nuclear means weapons, whether you consider a nuclear power plant a weapon or not. It was all born out of the atom bomb. You know, the uranium that came for the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs came out of Congo back in 1936, I believe. And that was the beginning, basically, of the nuclear weapons complex. And so we dropped the bombs in Japan, which were both weapons of mass destruction and absolutely acts of criminal genocide against the Japanese people in the 1940s, because we didn't need to use those bombs, but we did. just like we didn't need to bomb Dresden. In any case, from 1946 onward to roughly 1960 or 1961, the industry, the U.S. government had certain people that wanted to push the idea of nuclear power, of turning the atom into the so-called peaceful atom. And the technology was not there. The first thing they did was this guy named Admiral Rickover from the U.S. Navy. He decided to create a nuclear submarine, and he created his little fiefdom, a little kingdom, at one of these national laboratories that are today irradiated beyond recovery. And and we're still using them, by the way. They're called Superfund sites. And Rickover was able to build a small reactor in a submarine and successfully launch the Nautilus, the first U.S. nuclear submarine, back in 1953. And from that, they scaled up this tiny little reactor into these gigantic behemoth reactors that we see now all over the United States, which were many of them built from 1960 to 1975, and many of them built from 1975 to 1986, when I think the last reactor construction ceased, with one small caveat. There was a reactor in Tennessee, the Watts Bar Nuclear Power Plant. One of the reactors there was brought online recently, and so I was able to visit that reactor in 1994 when they were finishing the construction. But no new reactors have been sited since the 1980s, even though companies have come along and been created, nuclear companies, Entergy Dominion and one more, I can't think of the name of. These companies came along and they organized the U.S. government to pass a law which made it impossible for any citizen to fight against the siting, building of a nuclear power plant in the United States for the next generation of nuclear power plants. At present, there's 410 nuclear reactors in the world. There were 110 of these, I think, 55 of these in Japan. There's 104 in the United States that are operating today, and several of the U.S. sites have been decommissioned. And every single nuclear reactor site in the United States, from the 6 or 8 reactors in Pennsylvania to the 3 or 4 in New York to the 1 in Vermont, 1 in Maine, 1 in New Hampshire, 1 in Rhode Island, a bunch in California, especially Diablo Canyon and San Onofre. These two are very dangerous. And then a bunch in the south. We're talking 104 operating reactors that are all nuclear waste sites. Nuclear waste sites. Every single one of these sites is, if you're involved in an anti-nuclear activist scene, you know that we consider them, and I am an anti-nuclear activist, make no mistake about it. We consider these sacrifice zones. And what we need to do is, instead of the idea that we can clean up the waste, you can't clean it up. It's not waste. It's radiation, and it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tons of former uranium spent fuel rods that are deadly forever. And we're talking about those spent fuel pools in Japan. It seems like there are 6 spent fuel pools in Japan at the 6 reactors, plus one big spent fuel pool in addition to the 6, which was a common spent fuel pool. And any one of those spent fuel pools had over 30 tons of radioactive spent fuel rods. And each one of these, if we put this in comparison, what Hiroshima did, these are equivalent, was effectively, I think it's, the unit of measure is 1,000 curies, I believe. I may have the unit of measure wrong, but Hiroshima was effectively 1,000 curies. And what's important here is not the number I'm giving you, but the scale. So if Hiroshima was 1,000 curies, each one of those spent fuel pools, or the spent fuel pools in the United States in any case, contain 75 million curies of radiation. Each spent fuel pool at each of these many 104 nuclear sites in the United States. And the reactors in the United States are the same design as the ones in Japan. They're the same age. They're the same technology. They're the same people running them. It's not about Japan. It's about the United States. But the United States has been trying, the media has been trying to distance itself from Japan by saying, those Japanese are like those stupid Russians. They can't even run a nuclear power plant. They built it wrong. They put it in the wrong place. And they didn't know how to run it, idiots. This is white supremacy. It's nationalism. It's white superiority. It's ultra-nationalism coming out of the United States, that we are technologically superior to those stupid Russians and to those stupid Japanese, who just yesterday, meaning last week, were touted by the NRC as the best tech. They had the best technology and the best safety record and all this in the world. And these were the examples being used for why we should be building next-generation nuclear power. And even with all this radiation coming out of Japan, and all the evidence. Like, for example, today there, some media outlets are reporting the government has finally said that, spinach and milk are showing up with high levels of radiation in them. We're going to see a huge death toll in Japan. We're talking about possibly a large part of Japan being uninhabitable forever. And the media CNN has created this report today that says that it's radio, what did I call it? Radiophobia, that you and I, if we're afraid of nuclear waste, nuclear reactors, it's because we're irrationally afraid of something we don't understand. We don't have the capacity to understand. And that's not true. It can happen here. It's going to happen here unless we shut down Vermont Yankee and we shut down San Onofre and we shut down Watts Bar and Pilgrim and Dresden.
Right. You mentioned CNN and then some of the mouthpieces that spout off this nuclear stupidity, as you framed it. A couple of people that we ought to look out for, I think, according to some of your writing, is a guy by the name of Dr. Jim Walsh and a guy by the name of Dr. James Lovelock. Could you tell us who they are and why we need to be skeptical when we see what they're saying in the paper, on the news, et cetera?
Well, let's just take James Lovelock. There's a lot of environmentalists in the United States, good people. You know, I mean, we're talking about good people everywhere, whether they're criminally insane and working for the nuclear industry. It's really about a culture of secrecy and denial. The entire nuclear weapons complex was born in a culture of secrecy and denial, the nuclear weapon and the nuclear weapons complex. And when they license these nuclear plants and they put an armed security battalion at the nuclear plant, it's not because they're so much afraid of terrorists. It's because they don't want you, me, and Jane next door to walk in and figure out what's really going on. It's because you can go in there and you can immediately become radiated by the many so-called leaks, the radiation that's being dumped into the rivers and into the air and into the ground every single day that a nuclear power plant operates. So the industry has to cover its tracks, and the industry, like any propaganda industry or any industry, has to create people that will say what they want it to say. And these are the people who believe, in many cases, that nuclear power is wonderful. But the people stupid enough to go into a nuclear reactor walk right in because they've been told it's safe, and then they die a few weeks later of radiation poisoning, for example. I mean, Madame Curie, who invented, you know, basically was the founder of the whole radiation concept, she died of cancer. And so this guy, James Lovelock, he's a NASA scientist. And in the 1960s, he wrote something called the Gaia Hypothesis and published a book about, it's basically a wonderful thesis about how the world, the Earth, is a self-regulating organism. And it was considered a very futuristic and amazing, brilliant analysis of the Earth, which environmentalists adapted to use to say that we need to care about everything on the planet, everything. And this is a really important theme. You know, holistic thinking is essential. But the book has a few problems. And in any case, all these people, including myself, have bought the idea that the Gaia Hypothesis is this wonderful thing and that, therefore, James Lovelock is a wonderful guy. Well, he went on to work for MI5, which is British intelligence, in an MI5 laboratory in Britain. And he doesn't care about chemicals, and he doesn't care about nuclear radiation, because in 2004, he came out with a statement which supposedly shocked the world, stating that he believes nuclear power is the only way to rescue us from global climate change, man-made global climate change, global climate mayhem. And it's clean and green. And he actually said something like, no one has ever died from radiation, from nuclear accidents. And if anybody dies in Japan, it's not going to be from any of the nuclear radiation. It's only going to be from the tsunami and whatever else. And he's a complete quack. But the bottom line is he continues to work for the military industrial complex, and he's portrayed as an environmentalist, he's portrayed as a caring human being, and he's very, from my point of view, he's very eco-fascist. He's made a statement how the Russians were idiots, and the reason that Chernobyl melted down is because that's the kind of thing Russian people do, and it's racist. It's the same. It's right. What they're adopting now about to distance the U.S. industry from Japan in order to convince you and me and Jane next door that the nuclear reactors that are already operating are fine. We have nothing to worry about. Just take some Ritalin, and you'll be okay. Or that next generation nuclear, of course, which is these small nuclear plants that are nuclear reactors that are much more modular and much more sophisticated and probably much more effective, that these are fine too. But we haven't solved the problem of nuclear waste, and we haven't solved the problem of daily radiation releases. For example, the Nautilus submarine, when it traveled under the ocean, was releasing radioactivity into the ocean every single day. You can't run a nuclear reactor without water, and that's the problem in Japan. And imagine that. You've got these nuclear plants melting down because the power systems were removed and they can't run the pumps. But right next door, within 50 or 100 feet, you've got the Pacific Ocean. You've got an entire heat sink, a cooling sink. But you can't get that water onto the plant. I mean, they can't even get the water onto these reactors, and it's right next to the ocean. It can happen anywhere, and it's going to happen here. It did happen here. It happened at Three Mile Island. And the number of deaths at Three Mile Island were completely covered up. And by the way, I mentioned in my story three-headed cows near Chernobyl. And you can see this film. It's called While We Are Still Alive. And it's by Vladimir Kuznetsov, a Russian scientist. And he in fact has said that Japan won't be as bad as Chernobyl. And this was 3 or 4 days ago. He may change his tune. But in any case, he's not a fanatic. He's done some films, and he showed the construction of the sarcophagus, which was built over the Chernobyl site to try to keep the radiation contained. And if people don't know about Chernobyl, they need to understand we're talking about a huge area, far larger than Massachusetts, which has been evacuated and is radiotoxic today. And there's babies being deformed, born that are deformed with the spinal column is so weak they can't hold their heads up, and they've got growths coming out of their chest. There was a cow with three heads, a calf with three heads, and there was another calf with legs and a head, and it was born that way, but it had no stomach and no organs, so it died immediately. These are very real.
Right. I mean, Keith, what would the people have to do to reverse this? Reverse this trend. What would the U.S. population have to do in order to reverse this trend of this blind reliance on these, you know, over 100, you know, nuclear reactors that we see throughout the U.S. Like, what would have to, you know, as you mentioned that, you know, unless we stop this, what would we have to do to stop this?
It's not just the U.S. We got reactors in Canada, and they're big ones.
Right.
You know, these are big. The Japanese reactors, a couple of these are small compared to some of the stuff we're running over here. And we're talking about a history, for example, the Vermont Yankee. What can people do? Shut down Vermont Yankee. There was a local citizens groups, and here's some of the groups that people need to understand who are telling the truth. The Nuclear Information Resource Service, NIRS, NIRS, Nuclear Information Resource Service. The Citizens Awareness Network, run by Deb and Fred Katz. Deb Katz is going strong, and she's here in Massachusetts. And they shut down Yankee Atomic, the first and smallest reactor, one of the smallest reactors that was built in the United States, which was on the Deerfield River. And the Vermont Yankee is on the Connecticut River. And today at 1 o'clock, there was a vigil at Vermont Yankee because the people up there and in New England have been fighting to shut down this reactor. And you can imagine the kind of stuff that we're labeled with, farmers who live near these things. We're talking about, and I'm not making these stories up, do a search on, read my story and look at the links. And look at the references and read the Boston Globe article about irradiated fish, glowing fish in the Connecticut River because of things like the most deadly radioisotopes, which are cobalt-60 and strontium-90 and plutonium. And iodine-131 is the one that causes thyroid cancer within the first month of a radiation release. So that's why we saw a lot of thyroid cancers around Three Mile Island and around Chernobyl, and are going to be a lot of thyroid cancers around the Japanese reactors in the short term. But in the long term, we're talking about cesium-137. And these isotopes have half-lives of virtually forever.
Right.
One of them is, I think, 27,000 years. What is a half-life? People think, and half-life is another tricky language, because a half-life of 8 days suggests that it'll be gone in 8 days. Well, only half of it will be gone in 8 days. So if we had 10 tons of iodine-131, if you could have a volume of that noble gas, it's a gas, 10 tons of it, in 8 days we'll have 5 tons, in 16 days we'll have 2.5 tons, and in 32 days we'll have 1.25 tons, et cetera, et cetera. So Nuclear Information Resource Service, Citizens Awareness Network, the Vermont Yankee groups, from the Citizens Awareness Network website, you can find these different groups around the country who are fighting against companies like Pacific Gas and Electric, the San Onofre plant out in California, the Salem plant in Massachusetts, the Pilgrim plant. There's anti-nuclear groups all over the country, and we are not the fanatics in this equation.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have, and anybody can understand nuclear power. It's simple, but the way that people have been convinced that they can't stop it or can't understand it or don't need to worry about it is because the scientists throw a lot of technological utopianism at us and technological garbage and technological equations and definitions like ALARA, A-L-A-R-A. And this is a really interesting one because this is what makes it possible for nuclear reactors to operate every single day and release nuclear waste every single day into the air and water where we swim, in the Connecticut River or in the Pacific Ocean near San Onofre. Or every nuclear reactor has a body of water next to it. And so ALARA, A-L-A-R-A, is as low as readily achievable, or it's possibly as low as readily allowable. And what that means is, if I dump a glass of Coke on the floor and I can only clean up 90% because the rest of it sticks to the floor, you could call it ALARA. I got it as clean as I possibly could. It basically says we can't stop nuclear waste, and in order for reactors to be able to run, they have to release nuclear waste, and therefore we have to come up with some neat little definition which tells the public that everything's fine. And that's what ALARA is. It's we can't stop the waste from going into the water, tritium, cobalt-60, and the waste like cesium-137 is basically a waterborne nuclear isotope which gets into the water systems because every single reactor is drawing water from the Connecticut River or the Deerfield River or the Pacific or Atlantic Ocean or the Great Lakes, and it's putting it back after the coolant, after it goes through the system. It's a cooling. And it doesn't go through the reactor. It goes through secondary cooling, but secondary cooling is hot as those fish in the Connecticut River and as hot as those people, right, who are trying to shut down these Japan nukes who are sacrificing their lives. So the bottom line is
right.
There are groups out there. There's an anti-nuclear network. We have the power. Thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people in Germany have convinced the government to say no to nuclear power. It's just since the government was rethinking its position, but now they've decided to say no. And thousands of people in France are protesting. And so there's a Vermont Yankee vigil today, and people need to get connected to the network and stop these weapons of mass destruction that are going to completely destroy our lives. And one final point on that. People say that global warming is much worse than nuclear radiation, so therefore nuclear plants are the answer instead of coal. And I say nuclear radiation is far more deadly and dangerous because it destroys the cells, our genetics, and life is not going to be able to continue as we know it. Will have two-headed babies, which you see in that film. The kid didn't live. The baby didn't live. But with global warming, we can stop global warming, and we can put a solar panel on every house. But the industry doesn't want to put a solar panel on everybody's house because they can't control it. They can't profit from it. It's about profits, and that's why the story that I just published on my website just before you got me online is also talking about how investors in Wall Street investors are worried about this boondoggle in Japan affecting their profits. You know what I say to that? You can't publish on air what I say to that.
I like that. Right. Peter, the last question I have to ask you, and thank you so much for that verbal illustration that you just gave us and our listeners, and it's powerful. And I hope that people, to reiterate, that are listening right now, whether this show is on live or an archive, and we know we have thousands of listeners throughout the world. I please, folks, you know, pass this on to everyone that you know, and also pass along the links to Keith's websites that I've listed on our site and within the emails that everyone has, because this stuff has to get out there. But I want to reiterate, we need to support individuals like Keith Harmon Snow, because their work is so invaluable. It is like in this case, looking at Keith's work around this nuclear disaster and this possible apocalypse, it's literally life and death. Keith, my last question is kind of reverting back to Congo, and I just wanted to, because you've always you know, spared no mercy when it came to exposing people and naming names, and I love that about your work. You know, you name the names because it's important for folks to know what they're dealing with and who they're dealing with, and these these wolves in sheep's clothing that are lurking out there. And I want to know, my last question is, can you provide some insight onto who is behind Save Darfur, who is behind the Enough campaign, specifically this guy, John Pendergraft, and how dangerous their propaganda is surrounding, these projects, these so-called projects that they have on the continent of Africa?
Great question. Before I answer that question, don't let me forget it, because I sometimes talk so much I forget. But just I want to point out that if people read my – I encourage people to try to get through my entire story. It's written differently so that people can comprehend, and I feel that it's got important information that people just need to really understand how we're being lied to by the press, because that's significant. As long as the press lies to us, we can't organize our government. We can't organize people to take action to stop these atrocities that are happening against people all over the world, including us. We're talking about cancers, epidemics of cancer along the Connecticut River and along around clusters around Three Mile Island, et cetera, downwind and downriver. And so there's a lot of information there. There's a lot of organizations. You can find the Citizens Awareness Network link and tie yourself in and take some action. So who is John Prendergast? Well, National Security Council under William Jefferson Clinton. He's an intelligence asset. He went on to work for the International Crisis Group, which is billed as one of these. It's part of our, what I call our weapons of the human rights. So it's a human rights, so-called human rights organization, the International Crisis Group. In this case, it's tied to Zbigniew Brzezinski or Henry Kissinger. They're both tied in there. The International Crisis Group and the International Rescue Committee, one of them has Zbigniew Brzezinski, and the other one has Kissinger, and these are national security apparatus at the deepest levels. And Prendergast worked for the International Crisis Group, and then, of course, he was with the Clinton National Security Council when the National Security Administration apparatus when the Clinton administration invaded the Congo. So then Prendergast shows up a few years later as the head of this group called Enough. Enough genocide, enough war. We've had enough. Enough. It comes out of a claim from the camps in the Nazi concentration camps, which by themselves have some serious disinformation to be unpacked. In any case, it means never again, enough, etc. It's this Zionist claim to that the Jewish people are the only people persecuted in the world, and we need to stop the persecution of people like the Jewish people, including the people of Rwanda, the Tutsis, who survived genocide, nonsense, and the people of Darfur, who survived genocide, another kind of nonsense. Now, there was genocide in Rwanda, and there was genocide in Darfur, but it's not what we've been told. That's the political economy of genocide. So Prendergast is now running these groups that are basically all funded by the Center for American Progress, an American nationalist in the sense of, you know, fascist nationalist, right-wing think tank, Center for American Progress, which funds the Enough campaign. It funds the One, O-N-E, the One campaign, meaning every one of us can do something, so if you just do your part, we'll all be fine. Give $20, et cetera, to Save the Children, who's funded by Lockheed Martin or whatever. And then they also support the Save Darfur campaign, which is deeply connected to the Zionist Israeli lobby and the Israeli government. And this is basically covering up the story of the U.S. military involvement in Sudan, in the south first, and then in Darfur. And the Save Darfur movement, one of its biggest champions is a guy named Dr. Eric Reeves out of Smith College, which is right next to me. And Reeves has produced several books, The Long Days Dying in Darfur, for example. It's absolute propaganda. And he's been given all these places to speak in the New York Times, just like Prendergast and just like Nicholas Kristof. And these are the mouthpieces of the cancer establishment in terms of Japan, or they're the mouthpiece of the pro-war empire in terms of the war against Libya or the war against Uganda or the war against Sudan. And the bottom line in Sudan is the United States controls South Sudan already. It's an American protectorate. And we achieve this using some covert forces, some special CIA assets, in Rwanda who brought us the overthrow of the Rwandan government in 1994, that so-called genocide, and then went on to work in Sudan. And this would be a guy named Roger Winter, USAID, which is a CIA front. So basically, Child Pendergrass is, you know, it's an intelligence front, and they're propagandists. They've co-opted the movement to try to help the people of Uganda, Congo, and Rwanda, and Darfur, and Burundi. And their goal is to support American military power by making it look like they're humanitarian, and that if you join their network, you are humanitarian, and you are doing the right thing for those poor people of Africa. And they don't give you the names of the people that are really plundering Africa or the corporations that are plundering Africa. They mention some obscure, you know, obtuse corporation here and there, like Nokia being responsible for the cell phone problem in the Congo. Nokia produces cell phones, but they're not responsible for the problem in the Congo, even though we are all collectively responsible. It's smaller companies like Walter Kanzinger, former National Security Council under Clinton. His family out of Chicago, the Kanzinger family, deals in coltan. The Kanzinger today has a board of director on the Moto Gold in the eastern Congo. And Kanzinger is very deeply connected to the power establishment and the intelligence apparatus. And that's a summary of it.
Thank you, Peter.
Keith, you know, thanks. We can't thank you enough for sharing so much information. I wish we had more time just to unpack what's going on in Africa and Japan and the implications for all of us. And that reminds me of some of the language that you used in your one piece. You said that this is not about Japan or national borders. It's about all of us everywhere. And I think the same holds true for it's not about Libya or Congo. Or national borders, but all these things are interconnected and have to do with all of us everywhere. And your information and your inspiration in giving that to us, I think is helpful in getting us to expand our understanding of things from just national and local issues. But we do have to wrap up.
Can I quickly mention something else? If people want the truth about Uganda, they should not be paying attention to Invisible Children or these films like, all these Hollywood films, Hotel Rwanda or Shake Hands with the Devil or The Devil Came on Horseback, nonsense. But the Campaign to End Genocide in Uganda Now, CEGUN, C-E-G-U-N, that's a good group. Campaign to End Genocide in Uganda Now, CEGUN. And also out of Uganda, out of the Congo, Friends of the Congo. These are good groups. These are the people should be supporting. Not Enough, not Invisible Children, not One, not Save Darfur.
Great.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Yeah. CEGUN, okay, CEGUN. Also, let me ask you, just put your information out there for our listeners. Where can they find your information? Where can they find you? And how can our listeners support you and your work?
Thank you. My website is, I have an old one that's old only in the sense that I don't load stories on it anymore, but it's loaded with information, and that's All Things Pass. Similar to the George Harrison, All Things Must Pass, but this is allthingspass.com, one word. And that has tons of stories about the situation in Central Africa, Afghanistan, for example, and a lot about the nuclear arena. Especially, I'd like people to read a report called Out of the Blue, which is about U.S. Made weather warfare, how we're manipulating and using the weather as a weapon. And then my more recent website, which is going to have the new stuff, some hot stories about Mongolia and Japan and this nuclear story out of Japan and Libya, for example, and Congo, is Conscious Being Alliance. Three words all together, consciousbeingalliance.com. And both of those, you can support me through those, and I really do need some support. Yeah, it's hard to live on no very very small resources. And I'm not complaining. People in Congo are the real heroes here, and the innocent people of Libya are the real heroes here, and the innocent people, the black communities in Gary, Indiana, are the Native Americans. I mean, I don't need anything compared to those people, but it would help me to be able to do my work if I could get a donation now and then.
Absolutely. Again, thank you so much, and I encourage our listeners to visit those sites and to support Keith in any way that you possibly can.
Yeah, so thank you so much for coming on, Keith. I appreciate it, brother. I'll be talking to you soon, and we look forward to having you on again.
I appreciate you calling me, and I really appreciate you guys caring. I see the reports you guys put out, and it's wonderful that you're conscious beings, and that's part of the alliance.
It sure is. It sure is. So thank you.
You do need
so
more
much.
People to wake up, though.
Yes, need more people to get involved.
We need more people to stop reading the New York Times, because if they're reading the New York Times, they're contributing to their own mental illness.
You got it. Well said. All right.
Thanks,
take care, Chief. I'll be talking to you soon.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
All right. Be well.
Bye-bye. Man, Chief. I mean, Peter. Peter.
Wow.
Peter.
Wow.
I don't know where to start, man. And it's a shame we have 4 minutes left, but you know, your feedback?
Wow. I mean, I like to think that I'm fairly well informed. And my head is spinning. Just having listened to Keith and the tremendous amount of information that he dropped on us in a short period of time. Obviously, a lot to go back to, and a lot more things to go back and look at more in depth. And in comparison to, I think what stands out, in comparison to like Keith said, in comparison to the Western media outlets, the corporate media like the New York Times and the other media outlets. I mean, he said it so well. If folks are only getting information, and I use that term very loosely, from those outlets, they are contributing to their own mental illness. They're contributing to their own state of delusion. So, having Keith drop all that knowledge, I think, is part of coming out of that delusional state for all of us who wish to be conscious beings, for all of us who wish to be critical thinkers, and to have some real insight on what's going on in the world, because these things do impact each and every one of us. I mean, we're talking about a nuclear holocaust unraveling in Japan, and the very, very real potential and probability that more of these are going to happen around the globe, including here in the United States. This thinking that it can't happen here is absolute nonsense. Folks might be saying, well, we're not on a fault line, or we're not going to have tsunamis. Well, look, like Keith mentioned, the problem with the meltdown now is that they can't get seawater to cool down the reactors, and it's just they're within a matter of yards. Hundreds of yards away from the Pacific Ocean, so it has to do with a lack of power, a blackout. And if you look, there was a major blackout in the major portion of the east and Midwest in the United States. I think it was in just 2003. I mean, so it was just a loss of power. So something like that can, and unfortunately, I hate to say, probably will happen in the United States and other places around the globe. So, this is about humanity. We all need to take that very seriously in terms of what's happening in Japan as well as North Africa. And like he said, wake up. We need to wake the hell up. So.
Right on. And Peter, what do we tell folks every week, man? It's we tell folks it's as simple as this. We're not in it. We're not begging and pleading with you to support our show just simply by listening, and we're not begging and pleading with you to pass the email the link to each one of our shows onto your listservs simply because of some kind of self-aggrandizement or we have some money in it. We don't get paid by anybody. The reason we are pleading with you to pass it on is because the quality of information that we bring to the show with the quality guests, the likes of Keith Harmon Snow and so many others that we've had on this show before, it's vital that we empower ourselves. It's each one teach one. And so we're not rocking back. I mean, you can download the show. You put it on your iTunes, your iPod. You can listen to it on your desktop, your laptop computer, your mobile device. You can listen to it. I mean, all the disposable time that we have during the week, we can do that. We can fit it in. All right. Please don't let these kind of shows go in vain. Don't let these kind of guests and the information that Keith Harmon Snow had go in vain. You know, you can't. There's no. It's impossible to start any kind of movement and to sustain any kind of movement without a vastly educated on a certain level, you know, populace. So people are out there, you know, contributing to their own mental demise, as Keith said. Then we're doomed. How the hell are we going to motivate them and mobilize them and galvanize them to organize and to do what they're supposed to do? We just simply can't. So I'll end on that. You know, it's ticking 5, 4, 3, 2 for Your World News and for Peter Fowler. I'm Solomon. We'll see you next time. As Peter says, peace and unrest.
Peace.